Spartans, Joe DeSena here, founder and CEO of Spartan. I'm on the farm. I had the pleasure of doing my first ever online podcast interview. Okay, I interviewed James Altucher. He's got a famous podcast, and it was actually pretty interesting. I was nervous, you know, I've been holding out all the interviews we did over all these years. I said, I'm not doing one of these virtual meetings. It's gotta be in person, otherwise I'm not doing it, which is a nightmare. Because I'm traveling all over the world. Well, now with the lockdown, I'm locked down on the farm. James was locked down at his apartment. We did it. And turns out he went to Cornell. I went to Cornell. Turns out he had some tough times. I had some tough times. It turns out he's from Queens. I'm from Queens. Guy was pretty interesting. I mean, he's had some serious ups and downs in his life. I'll leave you with that. I don't want to give too much away. And he's figured out how to bounce back, how to dust it off his shoulders, and how not to get in his own head. I think you're going to learn a lot with this interview. I think he's a real interesting cat. So stay tuned, listen up, and listen. Life is not a straight rise to the top. Life is like this, and if you're lucky, at the end you're a little higher than you were at the beginning. If you're lucky, so pay attention. Let's learn something.
This episode of Spartan Up is brought to you by Gone Rogue High Protein Chips. Visit Amazon or GoneRogueSnacks.com and use the promo code SPARTAN25 to get 25% off.
Spartans, I am here on the farm with James Altucher. This is the first ever, you're hearing it first ever, virtual podcast. I can't believe we're doing it. I swore up and down, James, when we started this thing, and you did it too on your podcast.
Yes.
That I would never, ever do a virtual. I had to fly and go see people in person. That was going to be my differentiating factor, probably yours as well. And plus, you just, you know, when you see somebody face to face, right?
They say 90% of communication is nonverbal. So I always thought this was really important to be able to be in person with someone. So you get all those nonverbal cues and you develop a different type of rapport in person.
Yeah. So, but here we are, you and I have both, I don't know, I guess we've lowered the standard, James.
Or raised it, because now with remote, you're able to talk to more people and you're able to talk to people more in the moment. Meaning when this virus first hit, for instance, I was able to call epidemiologists from all over the world and just talk to them seconds later on a video like this. And it felt, let's say, almost as good as in person, not quite, but the fact that I was able to get so much topical information that was really important to people right then was, you know, made the difference.
It's definitely going to change our behaviors, because I would consider myself, and I continue to perpetuate the narrative that I'm a dinosaur and I'm not a tech guy. And like you just said, I've had to like roll up my sleeves and actually figure out how to log on to Zoom and do some of these things. And what it probably is going to do is, when this is over, and we could talk about when it's going to be over, but we're probably going to, some of those habits are going to stick, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, but what's really funny about all this Zoom, Skype, Squadcast, Zencaster, whatever it is you use, is that It boggles the mind how we can sequence, you know, the genome of this virus, and yet 100% of the time when I log into one of these podcasts, audio doesn't work.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
You always have to figure out audio.
I'm drinking some Spartan tea, by the way. I got to send you some Spartan tea right from Sparta, Greece.
Oh, and I'm drinking some Dunkin' Donuts coffee. So I'd be happy to try some Spartan tea.
Oh my God, I am about to change your whole life. Between the Zoom and the Spartan tea, you are gonna be on fire. So listen, I heard a rumor you went to Cornell.
Yes, I went to Cornell probably, you know, you and I are just about the same age, but you spent 4 years building a business, working, and then you went to Cornell. So probably I left right when you arrived.
When did you graduate?
Well, I did it in 3 years, and I graduated in 1989.
89, got it. So yeah, I graduated in 90. So we were there together. And what'd you study?
Oh, we were there together. So we were the same class, actually. You started in 86, I started in 86. I studied computer science.
All right, so you're much smarter, much better looking.
I'm gonna protest on both of those. But let me ask you a question. I started my very first business while I was at Cornell. So you were there while I started it. It was a business called College Card, and this was prior to debit cards being, you know, common among college students. And I started a debit card called College Card.
And part of the reason I'm vaguely remembering College Card is I wasn't fully matriculated. I was fighting my way. I wasn't accepted in 86. I just kept fighting my way in.
And so I
didn't know a lot of people. I was just studying and trying to do well enough where they'd finally accept me into the school.
Well, you know what? I was just having this conversation with somebody that if you're not accepted to a college, one alternative that nobody ever thinks of, but it sounds like you did think of it, is just simply go anyway and take classes, which you could sign up for classes, get teacher recommendations, keep on applying, and eventually you're going to get in and you're going to have all the credits.
It took me,
and you did it.
It took me 4 semesters. And the only reason I knew to do that is a friend of mine's dad was a professor at the hotel school. And he said, you can go non-matriculated and just do really well and prove that you could handle the workload. And
I so that's, if that's true for every school or?
Most colleges want to have continuing ed for adults. So that's why they open it up and you can go in and just take classes. The credits don't go anywhere unless you eventually become matriculated. And then obviously they'll take the credits. The problem is, as a non-matriculated student, typically they'll only let you take 3 classes. And you guys, when you're matriculated, are taking 5 classes. So you're getting 15 credits a semester. I was getting 9. So I was falling short every semester.
But you could go in the summer. It's all such BS anyway. Like, how much do you remember from any of the classes you ever took at college? Like, do you remember a single fact from college?
Well, the one fact I remember, and people, I'll deny it if you tell anybody, So the way I finally got in, and you don't know this, is my mom was a yoga teacher in Ithaca. And she was teaching yoga to Professor Anita Racine, who really changed my life, who ran the textile department in human ecology. Huh. So I was about to quit after 4 semesters of trying to get in, getting great grades, and they kept denying me. And they broke me. Here I am, this resilient person, and they broke me. And my mom says, go meet Professor Anita Racine. I teach yoga to her, and she might have an angle. So out of respect to my mom, I went and had lunch with Anita, and she said, hey, Joe, I run this textile department. I didn't even know what a textile was. And there's 90 women in the class, and we want some diversity. We want some men. Do you like textiles? And I was like, I love textiles. I had no idea what a textile was. So that's how I got in. And so when you say, what do you remember? I mean, I know the lengths of women's dresses, you know, the hemlines on women's dresses, when I see a movie, what year that equates to. So they're very important things I learn that apply to my life.
So when you're watching a movie, when you're watching Mad Men, for instance, the TV show Mad Men, which take place in the 50s, 60s, early 70s. Doesn't sound right. That hemline doesn't seem right. The hemlines were 3 inches higher then. It was a boom.
That's right. I guess because I fought so hard to get in that I probably over-index on how Cornell changed my life. Like, I just love, you know, it was a big deal for me to get in, right? If I was like you and got in the regular way and then hustled through it, I'd probably, you know, it's like if you do a hard Spartan race, if you do a 13-mile race and you're out there for 10 hours, that medal means something.
Right.
Right. If you do,
I will say I had a horrible GPA and I was probably not destined for college, but I had my own. I always am a big believer in that getting in sideways or through the back, you know, instead of the front door. And so I had to do that with almost everything in my life, including getting into Cornell. So I wouldn't say it was a battle for me, but I had to take a different route than most students.
Where'd you grow up?
I was born in Queens, similar to you, and I grew up in New Jersey. My parents moved from Queens to New Jersey.
So you seem like more of an entrepreneur than me, but most people coming from Queens somehow got the entrepreneur bug. that first business you built, that, and what'd you do with it?
Well, it's funny. So I built that started in 1987, going into 88, ran all through 88. And I had a buyer that was interested, which was MasterCard. And because at the time, again, they didn't really have debit cards back then. You know, we had maybe ATM cards, but they weren't used as credit cards. And they were very interested, but my partner in the business didn't want to sell. And then he ended up leaving for business school or whatever. So I was running the business on my own. And then the business just evaporated after about a year. And I was staying up all night delivering. So I was running this debit card, almost financial institution. But then at night, I was staying up all night delivering food, because anybody that accepted the card, we would deliver food from. And we had about 80 different businesses in Ithaca that accepted the card. And I was also the sales guy selling all the businesses that they needed to use, you know, they needed to accept our card. They didn't even have point of sale machines in many of these places. So, and then I would deliver, I'd do all these things. It was too much work.
You know, I don't know if you've been back to Ithaca lately. Have you been back in the last few years?
No. Maybe about 5-6 years ago.
It was a completely different place. Like, all the retail stores were kind of out of business. Very few restaurants, surprisingly. Very quiet on the street. And so I don't know if everything's gone so digital that kids are just not going out anymore. I don't know what's going on, but it was completely different.
You know, given what's happened in this sort of forced isolation that we've been in due to the virus, I think the same thing is going to happen. What you just said, where retail is kind of shutting down or going out of business, I see that happening now in places like New York City. Like right now, everything's boarded up, and you don't know if it's boarded up permanently or for temporary reasons. But it feels to me that a lot of these temporary shutdowns are going to be permanent. And I think that's going to start happening. And the other thing is, it's not as if anyone's going to come out of this quarantine period and say, you know what I always wanted to do and I'm going to do? I'm going to open up a clothing store in New York City. I think that's just not happening anymore.
That's a really fair point. You know, I'm very close friends with the chairman and owner of Saks Fifth Avenue, Hudson Bay. And he's a extremely shrewd, a talented individual. And his angle on buying Saks and Lord & Taylor and Hudson Bay was around a real estate play. And I wonder, even from an office perspective, if, you know, just like you and I were fighting on holding out on the podcast, doing them in person, I was like, everybody's got to come in the office. And now here we had this, you know, 60, 90, whatever it's going to be, days where we're just figuring it out. Are we going to go back to the office?
I'm going to start doing many more things remote, like meetings, podcasts, even meetings in New York City where I had to go downtown. It feels to me now like such a waste of an hour and a half to travel down, to come back up, when this seems like just as useful. And the same with podcasts. I really enjoy just calling someone up and saying, hey, in 5 minutes, can you come on my podcast? Like, I think a lot of things are going to change. I think we don't really know. Like, I think part of this as entrepreneurs is being a little bit more comfortable with uncertainty. We don't really know what's going to happen. But here's an example. I could see movie theaters shutting down in New York City, but that those locations, maybe restaurants, like maybe 10 restaurants take over a movie theater space, but just the kitchens, no more seating. That's interesting though about Saks Fifth Avenue. Like what did that guy say?
Well, he reimagines the space. He's an incredibly creative guy. And so he puts in a top restaurant in the space along with, you know, the Saks store, maybe some holistic health services in there. You can get stem cell injection. I don't know, I'm making it up, right? So you just got to get traffic in those stores. But I think when you look at it on a mass scale, like you said, if there are 5,000 storefronts, there'll probably be 2,500 when this is over.
I'm an owner of a small business retail space in New York City. I mean, among other things that I do, I'm an investor across many sectors of the economy. But just for fun, I mean, I don't own a car or anything. So this was sort of like my fun investment. I own a comedy club slash bar in New York City. And retail was already difficult before this happened, in part because of digital and other trends. But I don't know. I honestly don't know what's going to happen afterwards. I think there's a lot of uncertainty. We can all make predictions, but I think it's also the people who come out of this most successfully are the ones most comfortable with playing with possibility rather than certainty.
Yeah, what was it? Darwin said, it's not the strong, it's not the smart, it's the most agile, right?
I didn't know he said that, but that's definitely sounds accurate.
So and then you went on to build another business. After you left Cornell, you went to HBO first, or tell me about that.
Yeah, I went to graduate school for a little while. I was thrown out of graduate school, and then I worked at HBO, which was, I really loved it. It was the only job I've ever had. This is in the mid 90s. It was the only job I've ever had, and you know, a lot of people like say, oh, I hate working for the man or for the corporate job, but I liked it. I like being an entrepreneur. There's pros and cons to both, but I loved the brand of HBO. I think they were the most, you compare like their programming budget with Netflix's, and you compare, you know, the number of great shows that HBO has with the number of great shows Netflix has, and per dollar spent, HBO is still the king. And you know, it was just an amazing place, an amazing creative culture as well as corporate culture. So I loved working there. But while I was there, since I already had this computer science background, and now I was getting this background in the entertainment space, I merged the two, and I became very good at making websites for entertainment companies. So then I built a company on the side while I was still working for HBO. I built a company making websites for Fortune 500 companies, but mostly entertainment companies. So I built websites for, you know, Warner Brothers, Miramax, New Line Films, October Films, Loud Records, Bad Boy Records, Death Row Records, Interscope Records, AmericanExpress.com. I built the original AmericanExpress.com. And finally, after 18 months building this company on the side, I left my full-time job at HBO to fully manage my company. I was so risk averse that it took me 18 months.
And then you sold it?
Yeah, I sold it. You know, this was the time when all these companies were getting bought, and I sold it. And I really didn't know what I was doing. Like, I had no sense. I had never studied business. I had no sense of how do you value a company. I was a good salesperson, and I was good technically. But people don't realize there are other skills too. Like, how do you value a business? That's a skill. How do you exit a business? That's a different skill than coming up with an idea and executing on the idea. Selling a business is a whole skill unto itself. And so there were various things in this process I messed up on, but I sold the business, I made some money. And then another skill, which I did not have, which is there's three skills to money. There's making it, keeping it, growing it. So I knew how to make it. I didn't know how to keep it. And I just lost all the money. Like, I made millions of dollars, and I was smart. I cashed out completely. I had it in all cash, and then I lost every dime of it. It was generations worth of money, and I lost all of it.
What year was that when you sold it?
I sold it in 1998. So cashed out.
Did you lose it all in the market in the 99 crash?
So I cashed out completely in early 2000 before the crash. But then when things were low, like after, let's say, 9/11, I decided, yeah, this is a big opportunity now. And I was correct, but I just, there's various skills to investing. There's one is being correct on an investment decision, and the other is actually doing the decision correctly. And I failed at that part. Like, I just had no clue about how to manage the risk in investing at that time. I had to really learn and study. And I just was such a horrible investor in every possible way that I blew it all. I remember about a year later, I was so afraid to look at my bank account as I was losing this money. And there was one point about almost a year later where I finally looked at the bank account and I had $143 left in the bank completely. That was it. I had no...
What did you lose? How much?
I lost about $15 million cash. And $143. And that was like lost. It wasn't like I didn't come from like a well-to-do family. My family was didn't give me any money at all. I paid for my college. I paid for everything. I started my business from scratch. And we had to be profitable day one. I didn't really know anything about raising money. And and then I bought this huge apartment before I lost it all. And I was just a mess. I was just totally like in the worst shape possible. And then after I lived right next to the World Trade Center. So after 9/11, I mean, 9/11 was obviously really horrible for many people. And for me, I mean, I went totally broke. And then I couldn't sell my house because I lived right next, well, I was part of the crime scene and just, I couldn't sell it. And so it was just, you know, it was just something that, you know, I hoped never to live through it again. Unfortunately, I lived through it again several times before I learned my lesson. And hopefully, I'm knocking on wood, I'm learning my lesson now. But again, I was always very good at making it, maybe because I was so desperate or hungry growing up. And then it took me a long time to figure out how to keep it. And then the third skill is growing it. And hopefully, I'm at that part now.
We'll be right back to this interview, but I want to talk to you a little bit about Gone Rogue chips. These are not your ordinary chips. They have less than 2 carbs per ounce. They're made for people like you. They're made from real, fresh chicken, never from frozen, and it's baked to a crunch and seasoned with spices. They have flavors like chicken bacon, barbecue chicken, buffalo-style chicken, teriyaki chicken, and the flavors don't come from bottled smoke flavor. The chicken is smoked in a smokehouse with a blend of hickory hardwoods for an authentic smoky taste. So the Gone Rogue chips, they're light, they're fast. They're great for before or after your workout. They're easy. They're super portable. It's an easy way to get your fix with a crunch of a chip and the protein of a jerky. Visit Amazon or GoneRogueSnacks.com and use the promo code Spartan25 to get 25% off.
You had a tough time investing, but you went partners with Cramer at some point in your career.
Yeah. So what I decided was I took a step back and I said, you know, everything else I've done in my professional career, I've done with the help of computers. So I basically downloaded every piece of data about every single stock since World War II, and I wrote some software to model the stock market to take my own emotions out of it. And so my software would find these, what I would call anomalies in the stock market, like situations where people were overly irrational or overly greedy, and there was opportunities statistically to buy. And I would use that to make all my trading decisions. And that worked. So during 2002, which was a horrible bear market, I was up almost every single month. And, or actually every, all 12 months of 2002, I was up in 2003. And using that, I was able to start a hedge fund, which means other people gave me money to invest. And then, you know, it's a whole story, but then I met with Jim Cramer. I started writing for thestreet.com. I started writing a column for the Financial Times, for the Wall Street Journal. And then different publishers asked me to write books about investing. So I started writing books about investing. And fortunately, I'd already been doing a lot of writing for the prior 10 years. I had tried to be the great American novelist and failed at that, but those skills transferred over to writing financial books in a particularly unique style. And you know, that kind of became a second career for me, a second and third career, both investing and writing about investing.
What happened with that business? Did you sell it?
No, I had a, you know, I'll so one time it was very hard for me to raise money in a hedge fund business. So one time I visited this guy who was running a huge hedge fund at the time. And everybody told me, my friends told me, oh, he'll definitely invest with you. He's a really nice guy. This guy gave me a whole tour around his facility and he sat me down in his office and he said, James, whatever you want, you seem to know a lot of people, you know a lot about investing, whatever you want, what do you want? And I said, well, I'd love it if you invested in my fund. It would be complimentary to your own fund. And he said, James, I'd hire you if you wanted, I'd be happy to hire you, but I don't know where you're investing the money, he's saying to me. And the last thing we need here at Bernard Madoff Securities is to see our name on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. So Bernie Madoff refused to invest in my fund, and his returns at the time seemed better than mine. So
that was Bernie that you sat down with.
Yeah. I will remember being so disappointed leaving his office that how was I ever going to compete with Bernie Madoff? And so I basically started winding down the funds that moment. And because there's, he was just, if I couldn't raise money from him, and he supposedly was managing 60 billion, and I couldn't beat his returns, and I couldn't raise money, so what am I doing in this business? I had no edge. And I didn't know that he was a complete scam. Nobody, everybody says afterwards, oh, we all knew he was a scam. Nobody knew, and or very few people knew. And so then I started another business, which combined, it's always about combining different skill sets to create something unique. So I combined my investing experience with my writing experience and my web experience, and I created a kind of a social media website for finance only. And it was called stockpicker.com. And I eventually sold that for $10 million to thestreet.com. And, you know, about a year and a half after I sold that, I was totally broke once again and had to start over again.
What did you do with the money?
Well, the financial crisis happened, and, you know, and I had bought a house again, and then I got a divorce, and I just really couldn't, too many things. I couldn't really hold on to it. And I couldn't do it. I started investing, you know, thinking, oh, we hit the bottom. And instead it was another bottom like 8 months later. And, you know, I did some good investing then, but some bad investing. And I just couldn't hang on. And then the divorce hurt me, and then losing the homes hurt me. So I really was, once again, behaved inappropriately with my finances and had to start literally from scratch again.
On your during your podcast, do you think people enjoy your podcast because, one, you're so honest, you're humble, you're basically, you've been through the war multiple times, and it helps them maybe avoid making some mistakes?
I hope so. I think you know, it's an interesting thing with what makes a podcast or any media enjoyable, but podcasts have taken off so much, and it's really just like, it's like sort of the Wild West of radio. We're kind of like an unfiltered radio, and there's a combination of, you know, information value and aspirational value and entertainment. And so I like to, and I'm sure you do too, we provide all of that. You know, you certainly have aspirational stuff. You have guests on to provide information value, and then there's entertainment, people telling stories, and we both have lots of stories to tell, and so do our guests, and we know how to get those out of our guests. And I think that's what makes it good. I've been on plenty of podcasts where I could sort of, and I'm sure you have also, where you could sort of see, well, this guy's not quite getting it right, the format. And, you know, I've been in this business, you've been in this business a while, I've been doing this podcast since 2013. And you start to get a sense of who's doing it right and who's doing it wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm interested in you, because I'm listening to the stories, I'm listening to the peaks and the valleys you've been through. And somehow, I mean, you are the epitome of, you know, you get knocked down four times, you get up five, right? And so I think if there's one takeaway for the Spartan guests, well, for anybody, how do you do that?
Well, it's a good question to ask right now, because the whole world, and at the very least, the entire United States is going through this. I mean, we've never in the history of the United States, the month of March and probably the month of April will be looked back on as the worst month in U.S. history for the economy. And so we're all in this position where we have to deal with such, not only a bad economy, but also enormous uncertainty. And that's what you have to face when you find success and then go broke and you lose homes, family, all of your money. You go from having millions to having zero and no job, no opportunities. You find out very quickly who your friends are when you go all the way down. And in most cases, it turns out you have no friends and no family. And it's very, very painful, almost, you know, whatever is possible for your darkest moments, that's what you'll start to feel. And I think as a country, we're sort of going through that now. And a lot of people are asking these questions, like, what do I do next? And it's just like what we were talking about before, like, what will retail look like in New York City? What will everything look like in the next 2 months, in the next 6 months, in the next 12 months? We don't really know the answer. And living with uncertainty is a skill you start to build as you go through these peaks and valleys. And it's a very unpleasant to learn skill. Like, nobody likes uncertainty. And it's part of our evolutionary, our almost our genetic, our neurochemicals don't like uncertainty. We want to have certainty that we're going to have food, that we're going to be part of the tribe, that we're going to be protected from the lions. And now we're feeling that same trauma that maybe people 80,000 years ago felt when they were in the jungle, lost from their tribe, not knowing if they were going to be eaten or not. And I think, you know, what you have to do is you have to kind of take two steps back. So a lot of people ask me, for instance, right now, are there stocks to buy right now? Or how can I make my money back as quickly as possible? What did you do? And that's the wrong question. What I like to do is take two steps back and say, well, okay, am I fully taking care of myself? Am I taking care of myself physically? Like, am I sleeping enough hours? Which means, if I reduce stress enough so I can sleep well? Am I eating well? Am I exercising at least minimally? Are the relationships in my life good? Am I taking care of them, or are they toxic? Because you can't be creative if you're screaming back and forth at your spouse all day. Am I taking care of myself creatively? Because, you know, creativity is a muscle like any other. You have to exercise it on a daily basis or it will atrophy. So I have, as a practice, I have waiter's pads. I have hundreds of waiter's pads that look like this. I'm showing you a waiter's pad right now. And I write down 10 ideas a day. And I've been doing this for years and years and years, where I force myself to think of a topic and think of 10 ideas I can write. And that will actually rewire your brain creatively. When you actually need ideas to survive, it'll be much more easy to come up with them by just the simple act of writing 10 bad ideas a day down every single day. And, you know, and every once in a while you come up with a good idea. And then am I taking care of myself, as corny as it sounds, am I taking care of myself spiritually? So am I taking a little bit of time to look at the horizon and just, you know, unfocus from the daily, you know, anguish that is involved in living in a world like this? So, you know, those four things, taking that step back, that lays the foundation for, then it will just naturally happen. You'll come up with ideas, you'll meet people, you'll network, you'll have good relationships, and opportunities will happen. And that's what's always happened to me. And, you know, hopefully I don't go dead broke again. I think I've hopefully figured out some things. But even if I do, I'm kind of confident I'll see myself through it.
I'm going to connect you with some people, and I want you to join our, we have a 5:30 a.m. warrior call every morning. I've been bringing people together from all over the world, about 70 to 100 people.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I go around the horn, 5:30 a.m. Actually, the reason I came up with it was I was coming back from Greece when Trump locked down the country. And I said, I need to be plugged in. I need to be talking to everybody. I get my spiritual fix out of it. I get my relationship fix out, like, boom. And it starts my day.
That's awesome. And it's funny, you were coming back from Greece. I was coming back from the Netherlands the day before the travel ban. And I was worried, am I going to be able to get back? Because it was already on the horizon. I was in the Netherlands for 8 days and I was nervous even going there. Am I ever going to be able to come back to the US?
What do you think? I think we're going to be back to normal by July 1, based on my morning calls. I think we'll have some semblance of normal in May, a little more in June, but July 1, lights are on. And if there is any movie theaters left anywhere in the world, we'll be able to go to the movies.
Yeah, I agree with that. So I've been doing, ever since the lockdown, ever since Trump did the travel ban, basically the day after I got back from the Netherlands, I started doing these Instagram lives because I saw that there were the media headlines, which were all hysterical, and then there was my own view of the data, plus my own conversation, thanks to the podcast, my own conversations with doctors and economists and so on. And so I kept, there was this big gap between what the media headlines were saying and my own interpretations of the data I was seeing as confirmed by, you know, all the specialists in the space. And so I kind of wanted to use these Instagram lives to calm people down, or at least give people my interpretation. And I was saying then we should see a peak in the US around April 15th, give or take, and then an end, not a complete end, but like a basic end, kind of like how we're seeing now in other countries, basically by the end of May, early June. And that's what's bearing out. Like I would say in New York City's probably already peaked in the past few days. Italy and Spain have peaked. And then the US itself will probably peak around April 15th. You know, once again, nothing in my story has changed. The data has remained the same.
You and I are completely aligned. I love you. What time do you usually wake up in the morning? And don't be embarrassed to say 10 a.m.
Well, you know, before this virus was happening, it would be about 5 or 6 a.m. But now it's around 8 or 9 a.m. But I'm happy to change my schedule and go on these calls. It sounds fascinating.
That would be great. So we'll share phone numbers and I'll take you as soon as tomorrow or whatever day you want.
That'd be great. What software do you go on the phone or is it on a Zoom or?
We go on a Zoom.
Okay.
This was awesome. I mean, I could keep going, but I'm looking at the clock. We're 12:43. This could be the longest podcast I've ever done. Marianne is saying, I must ask more questions. I've just been so fascinated hanging out with you that she said, I haven't asked enough questions. All right. How did you start your podcast?
This company wanted me to write an investment newsletter for them. And I didn't want to do it. I really only enjoyed writing and interviewing people and so on. So they said, well, I said no. And no matter how much money they offered, I said no. And so they said, well, we'll host your podcast. Why don't you just do that? And I had all these people I wanted to talk to, and this gave me an excuse. Podcasts are great for introverts because this gave me an excuse to call up anybody I wanted and say, hey, can I talk to you? Like, I just read your book and I loved it. Can I ask you some questions about it? So basically every book I was reading, I would call up the person and say, can I talk to you about it? So I've had, you know, just like you, I've had so many fun people on my podcast, ranging from Richard Branson to Tyra Banks to William Shatner to Danica Patrick. And it's been such a pleasure. Although now I'm curious what you think. Like, there's 2 million podcasts out there, many interview podcasts, and I've been thinking of switching the format a little bit to more storytelling. I feel like I've already, you know, and you probably feel this way too, I've spoken to hundreds and hundreds of people. Like, after you speak to, you know, I grew up watching William Shatner, Henry Winkler, you know, and then in the 90s I had heroes, and the 2000s I had heroes. I've spoken to all of these people now. And now I'm interested in more playing with the format. What are you thinking of doing to grow your podcast?
Well, you know, it's really a shame on me, but it hasn't been the main business for us. Because the main business for us has been putting on events all over the world. And then the podcast really was selfishly, I just love talking to people like you do. And there were a lot of people I wanted to meet. And so you're right. I mean, I got that out of my system. There's always somebody interesting though. I didn't know you. Now we know each other, and so who knows where that leads, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of like that. And now that we got this new the friction out of the way of maybe, who knows, maybe we start doing more of these electronic virtual meetings. I mean, it's a pain in the ass to fly down to Richard Branson's island. You know what I mean? Like, that was a pain in the ass.
You know, I didn't do that. He was the one person I actually made an exception for in all these years, where I interviewed him on the phone. And because I figured I just can't pass up this opportunity. What a great thing to be. The podcast has given me these bucket list moments. And, you know, I when I was a kid, I was really into chess. And so I had Garry Kasparov, the best chess player in history, on, and we got to play a game. Wow. And, you know, just all these bucket list moments. And so now I'm just trying to figure out, you know, where do I take it? Because I do think we're doing the right thing right now. Like, you and I are doing this podcast during this time. I think anybody who's doubling down on content creation during this period is gonna come out ahead. And I've noticed that already in my download numbers and subscriber numbers and so on. So, so obviously this is something I wanna continue, but you know, I think constantly reinventing is important.
You have no choice, I agree. I'm always, I know what I wanna say earlier. You said most people don't wanna be in that uncertain zone. And I kind of like that zone. I think you like that zone too. Here's what I think. I think you and I put ourselves in difficult situations because we like to be there.
Yeah, it's a good point. Like, look, you're an ultra marathon runner. That's obviously, there's no way to say oh yeah, I'm just going to relax a little bit and do an ultra marathon. Like that, those two words don't belong in the same sentence. So, you know, and I don't want to say this is similar to an ultra marathon. It certainly isn't, but I've been doing for the past 5 or 6 years, stand-up comedy. And one rule I always tell people is if you want to learn something, if you want to be good at something, don't give yourself the easy solution. So for instance, if I was given the choice, let's say I was performing somewhere and the owner or the booker of the club said, oh, we have this world famous comedian on, do you want to go before him? Or the only other spot is right immediately after him, which nobody else wants to do for all the reasons you would think of. And I would 100% of the time say, I absolutely want to go on immediately after Bill Burr or TJ Miller or Tracy Morgan or whoever, because that's the only way I'm going to get better. That's the only way I'm going to skip the so-called 10,000 hour rule of expertise is if I take the difficult choice, the terrifying choice. And it's really true. It's the only way you'll get better at anything quickly. And so, you know, in comedy, there's another slot called the check spot, where you do comedy when the waiter or waitress is handing out all the checks in the club. And I always try to take the check spot. That's usually the beginner spot. Like none of the pros want to take that spot, but I love taking that spot because it's so difficult to do comedy when everyone's trying to figure out, they're drunk and they're trying to figure out the tip. So they're not paying attention to you and they're talking. And it's putting yourself in a difficult situation makes you get better. But at the same time, it's certainly unpleasant when you're broke or the entire world is shut down from a virus. And, you know, I guess all of those things were kind of practice for us for dealing with situations like this. So I feel like a little better prepared. And I just, you know, mentally and emotionally, but you know, there's always, I had to kind of like pull myself back a few times from being too obsessed with the data and just, you know, I kept seeing things in the data that were obvious to me, but not necessarily obvious when I watched press conferences or when I would see headlines. And I would find myself getting a little upset at a headline, which is ridiculous because I wasn't going to be able to change the world from Twitter. So I had to kind of learn very quickly in this situation, okay, I'm not going to change the world, but I can just be a positive influence on the people around me. And for myself, I can position myself in this situation.
We're going to love tomorrow. And who knows, if you get up with us and you do that call with us, I may even talk you into doing a workout with me live on Instagram.
Yeah, let's do it. I was just starting to work out with a trainer before this all happened. And, you know, we're the same age. So I figured it's more important than ever that I need to get serious about exercise instead of just like occasionally doing it. And so I haven't been doing that as much since they closed down the gyms and everything.
Let's do it. We're going to do it tomorrow. All right, James, that was awesome. Kings come from Queens. I'm glad we met. I can't wait to hang out again. We might hang out tomorrow morning. Let's do it.
Excellent. Joe, thanks so much for asking me on. And this has been great. Thank you very much.
See you, bud. Hey guys, what do you think? Should we do more online interviews? James was interesting. And I got to say, it made my life pretty easy. It made his life easy. We just went on virtually. But I don't know what the quality is like. I don't know if you liked it or not as a viewer or listener. So please comment. Let me know if you like that or if we should stick to what we've always been doing, which is going on site and meeting people in person. So I don't know. I mean, look, I remember my dad. My dad had an unbelievable rise to the top. He was a hustler. He made a bunch of money. And then the 87 stock market crash, 1987, he lost everything. And I watched it happen as his child. I saw so many people that had done so well in life and then boom, crashed and things fell apart. James is no exception, right? He had some really unbelievable times, obviously an amazing entrepreneur, but then boom, shit happens. Doesn't know how to manage his money. I love what he said, right? There's three components. You gotta be able to make money, you gotta be able to invest your money, and you gotta keep your money. Can't lose your money. So I like that. I hadn't thought about that before. Really, really interesting guy. Do me a favor. Comment, subscribe, tell me what's gone on in your life. I want to know if you've had some ups and downs. And make sure you check out our Instagram and you check out all the other channels as well. I'm not as savvy as all of you out there, but I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to have you subscribe. I'd love to have you share it with your friends, because Marion, Alberto, myself, the team, we're killing ourselves. Dr. Johnny, Sephra, Colonel Nye, to bring these characters to you so that you could learn. And so I just want to make sure you're getting the most out of it. And I want to make sure you're hearing about it when we release these shows. So stay tuned. I'll see you at the next episode.